Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Lob podcast with These Football Times. We're talking books again with another great title to chat about today. It's, I guess, in something of an offshoot from our recent series about icons of the game. So we're talking about record goal scorer turned presenter Gary Lineker, one of England's finest strikers, of course. Leicester, Everton, Barcelona, Spurs, throw in Nagoya Grampus 8 at the end, why not? Golden Boot in 86 World Cup. Iconic moments of Italia 90 and the sorry end subbed off when England needed a goal 2 years later in Sweden. An iconic career, iconic player, and I guess someone who's gone on to become iconic for all sorts of other reasons in later life, but we're talking more about him as the player today. With me is one of our TFT regulars who's probably sorry that Lineker never pitched up at the Hawthorns in a West Brom shirt. Is that right, Chris Lepkowski? Evening.
Good evening. I think we have more chance of Wayne Lineker than Gary Lineker. I don't think our budget would have stretched quite so far to recruit him, but yeah, that would have been nice.
Oh, absolutely. And our main guest is the author of this biography, of Gary Lineker, a portrait of a football icon. So it's a warm welcome back to the pod for Chris Evans. Hiya, Chris.
Hi, how you doing? Yeah, I don't think of all the clubs that Lineker looked at when he left Leicester and he was leaving Barcelona, West Brom wasn't one that I found. So yeah, I think you're right. I don't think it was just budgetary though.
Well, yes, let's keep the digs at West Brom coming. It's all to the good. It used to be me that got these for many, many times on these pods, but I think I'm free for at least another 70 years or so now.
Now you've won a cup. You've changed, you haven't.
Oh, I know. Sorry. Anyway, to start us off, Chris, we talk about the book in general before we delve into more specifics. So what was it about Gary Lineker that prompted you to write this? So why this player and maybe into what your memories are of him? And looking at you, you are younger than both me and other Chris here, which makes me think your memories of a player are slightly later in his career than ours might be. And I guess given your subtitle of the book, like I said, The Portrait of a Football Icon, what makes him such an icon as a player to you?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm 37, so yeah, he'd finished playing seriously by the time I was kind of anywhere near watching football. But I live in Leicestershire. My dad's a Leicester fan, so I've gone to Leicester quite a lot. I know a lot of Leicester fans. So I guess the thing is really that what attracted me to it was that Gary's story. There is a sort of BC and AD situation going on, really, that all of this, like, you know, as a player, it's almost forgotten about. And there was an interview with Jude Bellingham done in before the 2022 World Cup, and Kelly Summers asked him, he said, well, what do you know about Gary Lineker? And he said, well, I know what my dad's told me. He scored a lot of goals, but I think a lot of people my age would just say, oh, that guy off TV. And that is what most people know him as. And he, for me, you know, when I started watching Match of the Day, mid-90s, he was on there. And, you know, from then, he's always been kind of like the man in the main seat. So I think it's actually fascinating because you don't realise quite what went on in his story. And actually, again, you kind of think of him now and you think, oh, he was England captain, he was nearly record goal scorer. You know all the England stories, but you don't perhaps know all of what made him what he was and what made him give that springboard to be the presenter he is today. So it was kind of going into that and to say, being around Leicestershire, everyone's got a Lineker story, whether it's Gary, Wayne or his dad or the market stall. So it's kind of delving into that really. And it's quite an interesting story. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, there aren't many England footballers who have gone on to achieve what he has. And this is a man who has got to the top, the very top, of two highly competitive professions. So, you know, as a person, I mean, he's quite an interesting guy from that, before you even kind of get into the politics and all that.
Oh, very much so, very much so. And it's quite the transition. And I'm just, when you were talking there of people of a younger generation than myself and Chris Lepkowski, I guess, of he's the man off the telly. So I'm equating that to, in my youth, looking at Bob Wilson or Jimmy Hill, I suppose, is what we're talking there, Chris, isn't it?
That's exactly what Jimmy Greaves was to me. Saint and Greavesy.
Saint and St John as well, yeah, exactly. Yeah, you barely noticed them, as knew them as players at all.
Yeah, and I remember being shocked many years later when I found out Jimmy Hill had been a footballer, because he just didn't look like he should be a footballer. But I guess that's the great thing about Gary Lineker, and Chris rightly made the point, and congratulations on this book, by the way, Chris. It is a really good read. You're absolutely right that he's such a key figure for anyone who likes football, probably from 60 downwards, really, because we saw him dominate or certainly rise to the top in two World Cups. For him to then go on and explore different cultures, different countries, which during a time when very much an Englishman abroad cliche was around, you know, we didn't tend to do going overseas very well as footballers. And there he was conquering Spain and going to Japan, willing to put himself in different contexts to try and not only develop his career and maybe earn more money, but also just to develop himself as a person. And I think it's a testament really to where he is now and what he's achieved that, you know, he, in the conversation of England's sort of most iconic sporting figures, he would certainly be up there, not because he was necessarily a world-beating footballer, not necessarily, but because he's, you know, a David Frost of broadcasting, but because he brought so much to both different jobs and roles. And you know, he rightly deserves the acclaim that comes his way. And quite understandably, he's been a very good topic for a very well-researched and analytical book of his career and life.
It's the iconic moment is what I think of with Lineker. And you think of him as he's not a modern striker as we know now. He was a striker of his time, where scoring goals is what you were there to do. And he was bloody good at it, obviously. But it's the iconic moments. And for me, they're the ones in the England shirt. You know, the goal that he got against, the hat-trick against Poland, for one, I guess, is the first thing in the 86. And the goal against Argentina, and the goal that nearly could have been to equalise in a very similar fashion. And then you get the moments in Italia 90, the equaliser in the semi-final being probably the most iconic, and the penalties against Cameroon. It was it's great, great moments you look back on. And it's easy to look back and think it was all, you know, he was a superstar from right the way through. But I guess coming in 86, it wasn't quite necessarily the case. But prior to then, Chris, Chris Evans, he'd been at Leicester. He'd come through at his local club, local to you as well. And it, by modern parlance, you'd say it takes a little time to develop to the elite level, but that probably wasn't so unusual for the time again. And I guess, and you talk about his early days, of course, in the book, like, did he stand out particularly early on as a player, as someone who might reach the heights he did? Again, if you equate it to modern times, you'd expect somebody who's going to reach that pinnacle, you would already see it by the age of 19, 20. If not, you might consider it too late almost to make it to that level. But, you know, yeah, and we mentioned earlier of Alan Smith's is when we were off air. There's another one he played with along there, another future England international. And like I say, he didn't make that international breakthrough until 23, I think he was, and his real prominence came a year or two after that. So how were his early days? How was the Leicester City period for Gary Lineker, and at what point did it really mark him out for what he was to become?
He was one of a number of young players that were coming through at Filbert Street at the time. Jock Wallace was the manager. He'd obviously done great things up at Rangers, and he'd kind of taken over a Leicester club. He'd, you know, they weren't flush with cash. They were in the second division. They weren't particularly in great shape. And actually, I think when Lineker started kind of knocking on that first team door, they were struggling towards the bottom of the second tier then. And it was a case of, you know, would they even stay up there? And there were a number of young players, but Gary was one of several who came from Elston Road. I mean, he was obviously a good player. His numbers playing for Elston Road, his junior team beforehand, were ridiculous. He was, you know, scoring in by the dozen. But still, when he went to Leicester, he wasn't even the star man from a youngster from a striking point of view. Everyone seems to be talking about Dave Buchanan, who they both made their debut New Year's Day 1979. And Buchanan played through the middle and scored. Lineker played on the right. And, you know, he was very slight. He was quite small, got, you know, mop hair. And it didn't really work out for him in that game. He didn't actually appear again for another few months. And that was only when they got a bit of an injury crisis. So, you know, Lineker, it wasn't obvious that this was going to be the case. He was very, very quick, but he was also quite small, really. And, you know, by the day, you know, you could see he got knocked around a little bit, and Jock Wallace didn't fancy him through the middle at first. And, you know, as what goes on when he eventually goes to Barcelona proves, he didn't really like playing on the wing. So it was difficult for him. And yeah, and Andy Peake, you know, good mate of his as well, came through at the same time. And he was another one that they thought he was the one who was going to make it big. And Lineker had to bide his time. But there was, you know, Andy Peake I spoke to, and he talks about this moment that, you know, Lineker had been in and around and played a few minutes here and a few minutes there. And then they went away for summer and they came back for pre-season, and Lineker had just took a huge step. And whether that was because he was a late bloomer physically, or, you know, the hard work that he'd put in, a combination of the two is probably most likely. But he'd understood what his strengths were, what his weaknesses were, and really worked on them to make sure he was someone who had to be picked. And even so, he did that, but he was still the player who was getting brought in. And it was only when he got a little bit of a run in the team when Alan Young was injured that he finally got the opportunity at Leicester. And that was in the second division, scored a number of goals. And even after getting promoted, you know, there were still question marks about whether he was going to be the main man in the first division as well, and whether he could hack that. So, you know, it was by no means there for him. And you know, you mentioned England in 86. I mean, there were questions there about whether he was actually going to be the striker England needed, even though he'd scored so many goals for Everton, because he'd not gone to play for England and suddenly scored hatfuls. He was kind of in there, and he scored a few, like in little patches, but wasn't straight away. It wasn't like, you think, you know, think about Wayne Rooney when he broke through and you're like, yes, this player. Gary Lineker was definitely not that sort of player.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And I guess it's a career that gradually built towards a crescendo rather than started off at the start of a big crescendo like we would see with more modern players, or maybe people are just more fast-tracked now rather than coming through at their local club in the way that Gary did. I don't know. But anyway, he got his big move to Everton in 1985 after obviously showing sufficient promise in the top flight to get himself a big move. Now, this is Everton, who were the league champions at that point, and he was there to replace Andy Gray, as Howard Kendall sought to push things on. Lots of goals followed, but not the glory, narrowly missing out on a double to Liverpool. Now, I think, Chris Lepkowski, we've heard Paul McParland's views on Lineker and his season in Everton, I think, on a couple of occasions. Obviously, this was a move aimed at strengthening a very strong team. On the face of it, that there's nothing crazy about that. You know, this was a superb striker who was coming to the biggest prominence. He hadn't quite reached it yet, perhaps. But ultimately, it seemed to actually weaken the collective rather than enhance it. Or is that just confirmation bias, perhaps, of the fact that we look back and say, well, they narrowly missed out on a double. A few moments here and there, it could have been a very different story, and the success could have been his and Everton's.
It's a really interesting one, isn't it? Because this was very much the pre-squad game football version of football, where, you know, it was 11 players and a sub, and the sub didn't always get on. And of course, this was the season, the first season after Heysel, or so Everton, like so many several other clubs, were facing up to a ban, which kind of removed that need for Kendall to maybe have that extra striker, as he might have done had Gray stuck around. I think the other thing worth mentioning in this also is that Everton were strengthening from a position of superiority. They'd won the league. Manchester United were obviously one of the rivals at that time under big Ron Atkinson. And they really sniffed around Lineker. You know, they'd United at this point haven't had a 20-goal a season player since the 1960s. There's a real, although they've got some great players like Stapleton, Hughes, Whiteside, they haven't got a goal scorer. And all of a sudden, this guy scoring goals, who's quick, who would end up linking up well with Mark Hughes, is being pursued by Man United. And, you know, you mentioned Paul's views. Paul's our resident Everton fan, of course, our colleague on here. And he always feels that Everton had to adapt to accommodate Lineker. And I sometimes wonder if Everton actually bought Lineker to not only strengthen their own team, but to weaken their opponents and stop them from buying Lineker, like Man United and possibly even Liverpool. But it was really clear, and the stats proved this, that in 84-85, when Everton won the league, they had a massive share of goals distributed across that team. When Lineker came in 1985-86, they not only lost that talismanic figure of Andy Gray, who was sold to Aston Villa, but Everton became more direct. They changed and adjusted their style. They got the ball down the pitch a lot more quickly. And people like Kevin Sheedy, Trevor Stephen, Adrian Heath, although Adrian Heath might have been injured at that point, actually, but certainly Sheedy and Stephen, who had contributed to so many goals the previous season, they were only in single figures that year. And Lineker became a real focal point. And of course, it took him, as documented in Chris's book, it took him a while to get going. And I always remember Paul McFarlane mentioning that Lineker's cluster of goals wasn't consistent. There were that it took him a while to get going, and then he took a flurry of goals at kind of different parts of the season. And in some of those games that Everton didn't win, there was a feeling that he was the one underperforming. And I always find it, even reading Chris's book now, that relationship between Lineker and Everton isn't one of particular warmth necessarily. Maybe Chris might take a view on that from his research, but that's what I've always detected.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you mentioned Man United for a start. I think actually Man United did have a look, and it was Stapleton turned down a move to Marseille, and that's what blocked Lineker potentially going to United. But yeah, Everton, I mean, I think you mentioned the Andy Gray thing, and I think that's definitely came across. I spoke to Graham Sharp as part of it, and he said that he got a phone call out of the blue from Andy Gray. And Andy Gray said, "Look, Graham, can you come to the pub?" And of course he said, "Yeah, right." So they went down to the pub. And what had happened, Howard Kendall had turned up quite famously, I think, and had stopped. Andy Gray was unpacking a new house that he'd got there, and he said, "You're going to have to stop because you're moving. You're going to Villa." And I think the whole way that it happened, I mean, it was that abrupt and probably that much of a surprise. The players didn't expect this to happen, so the fans didn't expect it to happen. And, you know, this is a team that had been struggling, and then suddenly, you know, one of the star men, you know, had got such an affinity with the fans, was leaving. And I think that automatically puts you on the back foot. But I also think that there is, you say about the Lineker scoring in flurries, I think he scored a lot of his goals before Christmas in that season away from home. So a lot of the fans, Everton, didn't actually see the benefit of him. And bear in mind, this was a time when you're not going to be able to see it. It's not like today. So they didn't see Lineker, you know, at his best seems a little bit unfair, but they didn't see Lineker scoring the goals that he did for several months. And I think that probably did have an effect. And I think there's also a little bit of kind of looking back at things, because there was a feeling that, you know, when he went to the World Cup in 86, he went as an Everton player and never came back as one. And I think that's quite key too, because I think that kind of, it left a bit of a sour taste from many Evertonians as well. So I think that's where that sort of calling was, because it felt that it was, they felt, and certainly as league champions, you know, they should never have felt like stepping stones in the way that I think they did at the time.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, isn't it? And there's some nice quotes you've got at the end of the Lineker chapter here, which is called Goodison Goals, because of course he scored a lot of goals. You've got one Everton fan explaining all the reasons along the lines of our pal Paul, of his view on Lineker. And then Neville Southall saying, well, you can't call him a failure because he scored tons of goals. And I think that's really kind of, it makes you think of it in a slightly different way, because Gary Lineker didn't necessarily fail because he did what he was brought in to do, but the team as a whole arguably did with him in it. And is that his fault? I don't know. That's probably more management and style and approach. Loath as you would be to say anything negative about Howard Kendall for all he achieved at Everton. But obviously this one season sojourn didn't quite work out as well as the two seasons either side of it for Everton.
Just say to add to Chris Evans's point, that flurry of goals before Christmas, not only were crowds down and attendances down across the country that year, there was no TV, no football on TV other than a handful of England international, the Charity Shield, and a horrible game between Wales and Scotland when Jock Stein died. So a lot of these fans, much like Frank McAvenny, who burst onto the scam scene that particular year, a lot of people were bypassed. They just didn't see what Lineker was offering. So a lot of it ended up becoming essentially viewed through the pages of newspapers and reports and anecdotal versions rather than people actually seeing it. And I think that possibly really ramped up that whole thing around that curious relationship that he had with Everton and Everton fans.
I think it's quite interesting. You've done the Icon series, obviously, and I think this is where Gary Lineker sits very differently to some of these other guys. I mean, you know, the legend of, say, Maradona would be because people would say, bloody hell, there's this guy down here, can't believe what he's doing when you don't see him. But Lineker wasn't that sort of flair player, was he? He was very effective at what he did. And it probably was, I think, you know, Patrick Barkley I spoke to for this, and he said that, you know, Lineker wasn't the sort of person that you'd have paid your ticket price. You know, you paid your ticket money to go and see him, but he was the one who would perhaps have the big moment. So I think it's just the nature of the sort of player he was as well. Like he wasn't some sort of cavalier winger. He was someone who would be in the right place at the right time and score a tap-in. And, you know, that's great, but it's perhaps not what gets everyone really excited when you've got, you know, players who were, you know, got a bit more flair about them, perhaps.
No, that is very much true, absolutely. But the big moments often fall to these big players, don't they? And they may only do one thing in the match, but it's the one thing that can win it. Now then, off to Mexico in the World Cup. Now, again, I think similar to what I was talking about with the Everton thing, you can look back with the confirmation bias again and think, well, yes, it went really, really well for Lineker in Mexico, but it didn't start like that. The same for the England team as a whole. Two disastrous opening games and Lineker didn't really trouble the opponents unduly. And when the changes were coming in, he presumably feared for his place in the team. That him and Mark Hatley had been the partnership up front. That one tall target man, I guess, and one speedy finisher to go alongside. But ultimately, it was Hatley who got dropped and Beardsley came in, who ended up being a perfect foil for Gary Lineker. But at that point, that wasn't plan A, that was very much plan B, and it wasn't necessarily known that that's the way it would go. Obviously, those changes made a huge difference. England went on and beat Poland 3-0 with a Lineker hat-trick in 21st half minutes or so, something like that. All great opportunist strikes. A couple against Paraguay, and I remember him always being bitter about the one that Beardsley got that game because Lineker had been off the pitch for treatment at the time and Beardsley had taken up the position he would have had. So that could have been another hat-trick and obviously the goal against Argentina. But equally, how close was it to go in a different way for Lineker? This is obviously the decision to change the lineup and to keep him and to bring in Beardsley rather than switch it around another way. I don't know that this was necessarily a plan that had been hatched in advance. It was just something that developed as the tournament went on. How big a sliding doors moment was this in his career as a whole? Because obviously he stayed in the team and his career was made from what happened in the fortnight after that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned the partnership. So I think it took everyone by surprise. And maybe that's what worked initially. I think that Lineker played with Beardsley in the Soviet Union. And I think they'd kind of linked up to create a goal during that game. And that had been it. Actually, I think I spoke to Kerry Dixon for this. And actually, when they went to that, the pre-World Cup camp the previous summer, Dixon and Lineker had linked in 85 against the US. Lineker scored one of his best goals for England, actually, that day. Actually, one of the very few that were outside the box. It turned around and hit it on the half volley and went in. But that seemed to be working better. Because I think, you know, Dixon had scored two that day as well. And there was a feeling, again, because of this whole big man, little man, and you look at Lineker's past, you know, spoke to Alan Smith. Even as a kid, he played with a guy called Mick Duffy, who was a big guy. Graham Sharp, then at Everton. Big man, little man seemed to be what Lineker worked with. So Beardsley coming in was a complete breaking of the mould in that sense. But there were questions. And I mean, Lineker, it's difficult sometimes to read exactly what Lineker may have felt. And still now, because he is, by the nature of what he is, he plays up to being quite a self-deprecating character. So when he talks about the fact at the time he thought he might have been dropped in 86, you never know how serious that might have been, but he certainly wasn't a mainstay. He wasn't a dead cert that he hadn't scored for a few games. He scored a hat-trick against Turkey, scored his first goal against Republic of Ireland, and that had been it. And that the hat-trick against Turkey actually inflated his numbers, so it looked like his goal ratio was better, but he'd gone a lot of games playing for England where he hadn't actually scored. And there had been questions. I mean, England hadn't really created an awful lot full stop in those two early games in 86. So there was, you know, was it a Lineker problem? Or was it a service problem? I suppose scoring a hat-trick suggests that it might have been a service problem in the end. But yeah, there were certainly question marks over whether Lineker was the man. And had they lost and, you know, hit a blank against Poland, you may well have found that would Bobby Robson have kept his job? Would somebody else have come in, and would they have had a different idea of what they wanted to do? Because, you know, Lineker was very much a he scored goals player, and you might have found a striker who perhaps did a little bit more for the rest of the team as well. And so, you know, it really was. I mean, you say it's a sliding doors moment. I mean, potentially it could have gone completely in the other direction for him.
Well, quite. I mean, you bring in the Barcelona move into that as well, which was obviously going on during this tournament. There's a excellent, speaking of clips of TV punditry, the discussion with Laurie McMenemy and Terry Venables in the match of the day, or the live coverage studio, with Lineker there looking decidedly uncomfortable while they argued about whether he should be getting tapped up or not. Chris Lepkowski, how much, speaking on 86 again, how much of how we view Lineker do you think at the time has come down to what he did in those few weeks? We talk of how it could have possibly gone a different way. But ultimately, this is what's built his reputation. What happened across the course of what is probably only 10 days or so, where he scored goals in those three games.
It's quite simple. It's all down to the Poles, isn't it? Poles bailed you out again. Yet again, the Poles came to the rescue. I was dreading, not dreading it, but I knew this would be coming up, and that hat-trick. I was tickled by Chris's comments about Lineker not necessarily being a mainstay at this point. And you've got to remember that one of the pundits on ITV during this World Cup was Mick Shannon, who spent the entire World Cup calling him Gary Lineker.
Gary Lineker. Oh, God. It's all coming back, Chris. I remember it well.
You know, it's not that difficult to get Lineker right. But Mark Hatley at this point is leading the front line for AC Milan. So for Robson to drop the Milan striker for this guy who's had a good season at Everton, but, you know, do we know what he can do at international level? It's a bit of a gamble. And to bring in Beardsley, and again, very much a player who's better years would follow after this World Cup, I think it's fair to say, with Liverpool. It was a huge gamble. And not only that, but you can't underestimate the impact it had on the England camp to lose not just the captain in Brian Robson, but also the guy next to him in Ray Wilkins, who was such a cultured footballer and somebody who it was firmly believed would be a key player in Mexico. To somebody who could slow the game down when necessary, who would probably be best accustomed to that climate, the altitude, certainly the climate, because he was playing in Italy with Hatley at Milan. And to lose both of them, one to injury, one to a ridiculous suspension in Wilkins's case, laid on so much pressure. And you can't underestimate the call that Robson had to make with that team. But it is interesting. You ask whether how much this World Cup influenced that move. It's clear from Chris's book that the wheels were already turning as regards Barcelona, and that it was going to be a case of when. But to turn it the other way, Aidan, back to your question, is how damaging would a poor World Cup have been for Gary Lineker's stock at this point? It does make you wonder, doesn't it, whether that move to Barcelona might not have materialised, or maybe because Terry Venables was manager, it was always going to happen. But there are three games there, Poland, Paraguay, Argentina, and everything we think about Gary Lineker at that World Cup features around just those 270 minutes, and that's all it takes to completely shine a different light on a player's career at that point.
Good old Poland, eh, Chris? Making careers, yeah. Good stuff.
If only Newcastle had played Poland more often, the matter wouldn't have been.
Well, I did notice the slight aside of Peter Beardsley's lack of joy up until he moved to Liverpool, but I'll let that one slide. Anyway, off to Barcelona he did go. Three seasons there, and then ultimately another three seasons at Tottenham following that, linking up with Gascoigne there, as he would do in the next World Cup also. The goal steadily flowed again. The single-minded confidence, I think, that we associate with supreme goal scorers was very much in evidence. Chris Evans, more on him as a player and the style of play, I think. Do you think his particular sort of tunnel vision, narrow focus, I think this was evidence in the World Cup as well, where he would view the World Cup as a big success, and he got over the defeat to Argentina very quickly because he was top scorer and was in line to win the Golden Boot, which he ultimately did. It's very sort of tunnel vision of a striker, I think, isn't it, of just seeing your little bit of the world. Do you think that sort of helped him in his career as well as his calm demeanour, I suppose?
Well, I think it's the same characteristic, isn't it, really, that if you're a great striker, and you hear about all of the great strikers from all of the generations, is if you miss, because you will miss, and you'll miss some stinkers, if you can just forget about it and move on, because that's happened and you can't change it, then that sort of rational thinking, which is so difficult to have, helps you. So then conversely, you know, 86 Argentina, I mean, it did help. I think the moment when he nearly scored right at the end, he collided with the post and he was actually injured. And as the story goes, he probably wouldn't actually have played in the semi-final anyway. So his World Cup was done anyway, it seemed. But I'm sure he still would have wanted England to win. But the point being is that that was over, and there's no point in spending emotion on being annoyed about that. And I mean, look, nobody who's ever watched England or any of their, you know, their own side, that doesn't matter, because when you're in that moment and you've watched your team, there's an injustice against them or something like that, you can't, even if you've not been playing, you can't let that go easily. But Lineker had this brilliant way of doing that. And, you know, I think he, there are certain bits during his entire story where you kind of find there are times where you realise that he is human. Like the 91 FA Cup final, he missed a penalty in the first half. And I spoke to Paul Stewart for that, and he obviously equalises after half time. And Stewart remembers Lineker coming over to him and just saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. Because clearly it had been playing on his mind. But this was like one, the FA Cup final was quite rare, because no other time did you necessarily get that read that Lineker ever kind of looked back and thought, oh man, I could have done this better, or I regret this, because he just moved on. And I think that's probably is what made him what he was, because he was so resilient and so good at saying, okay, that didn't work out well, but, you know, better to move forward than to worry about the past. So, and that's a big, big part of his story, I think.
I think that's an elite sportsman characteristic, isn't it? But I think you're right, in football terms, the striker gets at the most. You could equate it to a tennis player forgetting the bad shot that they've made to be able to focus on the next one and so on. It is the way that the elite seem to manage to be. The mere mortals would dwell on things far more. And equally, I think one of the quotes that he's said about his style of play is, like I say, he was no modern striker to our eyes now, but he was perfect at getting on the end of things. He didn't hold up the play. He made lots of runs into the channels, into the right spaces, but the ball doesn't always come to you, but he keeps doing it again and again and again. And you can say the right place at the right time, but he would counter and say it's not about being in the right place at the right time. He would say he's in the right place all of the time, but the ball doesn't always get there. And that's a real skill. That's a real knack to have that only the very best strikers have. You see it again with maybe Harry Kane in more modern times, that he just happens to be at the right spot and the ball just drops to him. And you're watching it and you're thinking, well, I could have scored that one. It's easy. How did he get there? How did he get there with no defenders around him? And how many times has he been there waiting for the ball to come and it hasn't come? But to do it again and again and again. Perfect striker for that era with that kind of style, Chris Lepkowski, don't you think? It's very much, you just keep doing it, keep making those runs, keep finding the space, keep being in the right position. Always forward focused with Lineker as well. It's none of this sort of rushing back, none of this hold up, none of this sort of link up in that kind of style, unless it was to get the ball back again on a 1-2 probably.
I mean, we'll touch on this, I'm sure, but I think one of the problems that he found when Graham Taylor became England manager is that the demands that Taylor and his coaches put on Lineker and wanted from their strikers were completely different to Lineker's strengths. You know, that was Lineker's game at the time. He had this incredible burst of pace. And what I found really interesting from Chris's book is that he knew that he had defenders rattled. You know, there's the brilliant story of the 1991 FA Cup final when Forest have played Tottenham in a league match and Steve Chettle's been deployed to mark Lineker at the game. And Lineker gives him a really easy night, And subsequently, Brian Clough deploys Chettle in exactly the same role in the Cup final, with devastating results, because Lineker actually has a brilliant first half and tears him ragged and runs him ragged. That's why he had that incredible pace and he used it so well. He used it incredibly well. And if you watch the 86 Cup final and the goal that Lineker scores in that, when he has a really good, and Everton have a really good first half, it's all down to his pace. You know, that is him reacting quicker than Alan Hansen, quicker than Grobbelaar to pounce on that loose ball. And that's what he had. And that was such an asset to him. And I look back now and find it really unusual that he retired in the way that he did. His career went the way that he did. But maybe that was him recognising that the strengths and the power that he had and the pace that he had, more so, was starting to leave him and starting to desert him. And rather than carry on winding down his career, a bit like Rush did, I mean, Rush went off to Leeds, he went off to Cardiff, I think, was it, or Wrexham, and kind of...
And Newcastle.
I was going to say, he went somewhere else, didn't he?
Yeah, and he kind of... he was still going in the towards the late 90s, whereas Lineker took that decision that, no, that is me done. I'm not going to wind my career down. I've had my great period. I'm losing some of those powers. Now it's time to focus on another move and to start thinking about what I'm going to do after my career.
I think there's also the element of football moving on. You know, you talk about Graham Taylor and the change. I guess he had a little bit of this at Barcelona as well, where Johan Cruyff had started to come in and was looking at a little more all-round contribution from his forwards as well. The game evolves and people's style either adapt and adapt with it or it doesn't. And you can quickly become yesterday's man, especially if you lose out some of your physical attributes as well, as Chris was talking about there. Not that he was necessarily yesterday's man by the late 80s, of course. He was still perfectly suited to the English game at that point, but maybe we were a little bit behind the likes of Barcelona. In international terms, he obviously had a very poor Euro 88, as did England, but in his case, he'd been playing while ill from hepatitis. The quote you have at the start of that chapter is how he sat down and simply couldn't get up again, and that says a lot about his physical state at that time, which wasn't known about until after. But by 1990 in the World Cup, he was obviously one of the certainties in Bobby Robson's team. I guess the thought of going into a tournament without Lineker as your main man would have been unthinkable at that point. And again, he had another successful tournament going further, even though not quite scoring as many this time around, but still pivotal to all. I mean, Chris, how do you view his second World Cup and his contribution to it? Because by this time, he's a bona fide world star, of course.
He is, but interestingly, in 1990, well, before that, in that gap between 88 and 1990, when he struggled in that third season, the season after Euro 88, when he'd obviously started the season with hepatitis in Barcelona, stuck out on the wing, he wasn't really getting much opportunity with Cruyff. He actually went nearly a year without scoring for England. And so Bobby Robson did actually consider, a fleeting consideration, may I add, but he did consider dropping Lineker because he thought, how long can I let this go on for? And he did confide, you know, in people close to him at the time that he was considering dropping Lineker. I mean, look, as soon as Lineker scored, then I think it's completely off my memory. He scored against Albania in a game that was really near to being a year. And he scored, and that was him back. But for that little period of time, there was an opportunity that he was, you know, considering, you know, should I swap it out? Because there were a lot of players coming through. You've got to remember you started coming into a time in the 90s where there were a lot of good English strikers that could have pushed him. But he soon was back there, and he was the main man. And look, the way he finishes, you know, Cameroon, everyone talks about Gascoigne, and rightly so. But in the same way I was saying about, you know, what makes an icon, everyone got excited about Gazza because of what he could do. And you could see what he was doing, and it was all there. You know, the emotion as well kind of added to it. Lineker wasn't that sort of player, but in the biggest moments, it's always Lineker. Against Cameroon, he scores twice. He wins the penalties. He, you know, he scored the equaliser against West Germany in the semi-final, and it's such a brilliantly taken goal, and it's so quick, and that intelligence that, you know, there's no sort of thinking about what he's doing. It's on a snap and it's done, and that's what he brought. And I think that's what Robson and everyone else realised he could do, and his teammates always knew that with Lineker on the pitch, there was always a chance because he just needed a sniff. And he might not be heavily involved for half an hour, but you couldn't leave him alone. And actually, I spoke to Pierre Littbarski about this and obviously what it was like in the West Germany dressing room in that semi-final. And the person they feared most was Gary Lineker for that very reason. Everyone might have been talking about Gascoigne, but Lineker was the one who could do the most damage to you. And that's what's quite interesting, really, because that's 1990, although Lineker does score his goals, everyone remembers it for Gazza first and foremost, right? But it is interesting where Lineker ranks among his peers in that sense.
No, absolutely. That's, you're quite right. I mean, in terms of the big moments, they fall to him, and you wouldn't want them to fall to anyone else. That snapshot in the semi-final as the West Germany defenders couldn't quite deal with the ball coming in, bobbling a little bit. But for him, it was just clinical, bang, done into the corner of the net before Ilvner could even move. You can't imagine any of the rest of the squad would have been as clinical in that key moment had it fallen their way, potentially anyway. Then ultimately, we go on another year or two. You talk of critical moments, even in the qualifiers for Euro 92. Sorry, Chris Lepkowski. I do recall last-minute goals against Poland again, I think, that time around, just when it was needed, as ever. But also, he obviously fluffed his chance to equal Bobby Charlton's scoring record with a rather poor attempt at a Panenka in a friendly pre-Euro 92. But of course, he'd knock in a couple of goals at that tournament in Sweden, wouldn't he, Chris? Surely.
I find the Graham Taylor era as England manager a completely different podcast that we should do. I struggle to think of a man so out of his depth, really, as England manager. And I think one of the problems that Taylor had a problem with seniority in this particular period. He's lost quite a few of the players that like Berkshire, Shilton have both retired from international duty. Robson is pretty much spent as well. I know he plays a couple of games under Taylor, but he wants them gone because he wants to build his own players. He wants to build it. He wants to build his own team, his own put his own identity on it. And Lineker's the kind of remaining bastion, if you like, from that late 80s team. He's the one who's still there, who has a big voice, is a big influence in that dressing room. And the one thing Lineker, that Taylor gets really wrong is how he handles Lineker, in my view. Not only taking him off in that key game against Sweden in the European Championships, which even now, when you watch that back, or when I was reading Chris's book, you think, why would you do this? Why would you take off this talismanic figure? I've just listened to you talking about that that Germany game in 1990 when he equalises. And I actually lay quite a lot of the blame around Taylor's treatment of Paul Gascoigne at the door of how he treated Lineker and how he treated Waddle, because Lineker and Waddle were discarded way too early by Taylor, in my view. And that had a massive impact on Paul Gascoigne, because the two players that Gascoigne really gelled with were his Tottenham teammate, Lineker, and Chris Waddle, his compatriot, and Peter Beardsley being the third, again, discarded too early. And I think that had a detrimental effect on Paul Gascoigne. It had a detrimental effect on England. And I just find that Taylor never really came to terms with having Lineker there. It always felt like he would want him gone at some point. And Chris rightly points out that there were some young players emerging. Shearer was emerging. Ian Wright was would have been moving to Arsenal. David Hurst is emerging. Alan Smith, the Arsenal striker, is starting to figure more and more. But it always felt uneasy, that relationship between Lineker and Taylor, and indeed Taylor and any of those senior players. It just never felt right. And it didn't feel like, when you think that England had gone so close to the World Cup in 90, and to be so poor and to be faltering so badly within 2 years with some of the players that Taylor was selecting, it just didn't feel right at all. And it was such a sad way for Lineker to end his international career.
I was going to say, I mean, it's quite interesting actually, again. I mean, this is where this going back and you draw the you know, join the dots a little bit. And as much as that relationship in 92 did not work out, and bear in mind that Lineker was Taylor's captain, which is even more incredible that he treated him the way that he did. Well, treated him. They kind of fell out in the way that they did, and they perhaps didn't gel, because you'd think that bond should be rock solid. But actually, Graham Taylor did try to sign Lineker very early in his career when he was at Leicester. He'd wanted to bring him in as a replacement for Luther Blissett at Watford, and it just hadn't kind of come about. But that was quite a strong rumour. But yeah, I think that, I mean, there's one of the big quotes that kind of came out, and I think this is where, again, so Patrick Barkley, when I chatted to him, he was saying that there were a few press conferences where Graham Taylor spoke quite honestly. Now, there was this question of whether it was off the record or not, but he'd said after one game on the run-up to Euro 92 that it was like playing with 10 players with Lineker. This was his captain he was talking about. And there's a lot of journalists, because they liked Graham Taylor, that they protected him and didn't use him. But there were also a handful of them, I think Barkley included, who said, well, look, it's very much on the record. And they reported the story. Certainly Taylor hadn't said this is off the record, as would have to be the case, right? So they run with the story that Graham Taylor said this. And you think, how on earth does that relationship survive? And I think, you know, you say it has a knock-on effect. Alan Smith talks about the players knew that there was a bit of a problem there and that they didn't quite work together. And I suppose, you know, that sort of friction can't help a camp, especially when this is almost, you know, let's take it from a cultural point of view, captain, manager, that's coming from the top, that there's that uncertainty. So I suppose it's probably, it's perhaps shows you can follow all of the sort of symptoms that led to that, you know, that poor time for England with Taylor as manager, perhaps, you know, can be bottled up, and you can show it, you know, characterised by the whole Lineker-Taylor conundrum almost. And, you know, two people who were very popular just didn't seem to gel at that time.
That's a really interesting point, because you can obviously get what Taylor was driving at. It was a stupid thing to say publicly. It just reminds me of another quote earlier on in your book from Paul Breitner, and I think it was about 86, where he said, "I saw Lineker touch the ball about 8 or 9 times in the tournament and score 6 goals." That's what he was there for. That's what he did, and that's what he could do. And, you know, it's naive or foolish, I guess, rather than naive, foolish to think that he had to be involved in all the other bits of play when he then brought that much to your team, certainly in that day and age. Well, 92, obviously the summer of 92, it ended his England career, but he'd also moved on from Tottenham that summer as well and moved off to Japan, which didn't particularly work out. And a couple of seasons there of only a few appearances. Injury took its toll, and obviously he'd moved on from the top level of football by that stage. So if we look back then on his career as a whole, Chris Evans, where do you put Lineker in the overall pantheon of England strikers? We're talking more England again here. You know, obviously, Rooney and Kane have surpassed his goals record since, but they got more opportunities, I suppose. Kane's gone deeper into tournaments, but he's won a golden boot like Lineker. How do you compare and rate Lineker in against the past and the present?
I mean, I think it's difficult because, you know, football has moved on and it changes. And I think, you know, you would look at some players and you'd say, you know, even you look at Paul Gascoigne and, you know, was brilliant. But by today's standards, because he tried too much, someone like Pep Guardiola would probably tell him he's giving the ball away too much. So, you know, how do you do it? But the best players, and Lineker was so intelligent with the way that he did it, it's very difficult to compare him against, because you say, oh, look, Rooney and Kane do a lot more. Now, Gary Lineker being the person that he was, he probably would have found a way that he would have contributed more, because that was the sort of person he was. So, yeah, on the face of it, the way that he played, you'd think, yeah, perhaps he perhaps need to do more to earn that. Although you look at Erling Haaland now, you know, he, again, he's a man who doesn't always touch the ball, but then he'll be on the end of it and score a hat-trick. So, you know, there is a lot of that going on. And I think Lineker was such an expert at doing that. He would still have a role now, even in a time of needing to be doing more for the team. So where does he compare? I think, I mean, look, I guess the point is you're not comparing apples with apples, but you would say, yeah, look, Kane and Rooney, because they offer more, you perhaps think that's something that they would rank higher than him. Jimmy Greaves was a fantastic goal scorer and was perhaps only robbed by injury because he was out as England got on that run in 66 from kind of being considered even more of a great than he already is, because he could well have been in that team. And Jeff Hurst had his place. So, you know, it's one of these. I think he's certainly got to be in that, you know, the top five for Lineker. But would he have been higher? Would he have been better had he been at a different time? I would argue that he probably would have done. So, yeah, it's difficult. It's like in any sport, you know, tennis, Formula One, how do you compare an Ayrton Senna to Max Verstappen? You know, how would you ever do that?
It's a fair point, but I'm still going to make you do it anyway, Chris. What do you think?
Well, that's a good question. I think I'm at the risk of repeating a lot of what Chris said. I think the game is so different now, and there are so many different demands put on players. It's interesting because of the age I am, and because I really got into football at the very height of Mexico 86 and that period, I always use Lineker as a bit of a barometer, actually, when it comes to England strikers. I always think, well, although Kane and Rooney have surpassed him, and there have been other great England strikers over the years, like Shearer, people like that, Lineker's always my go-to because of the way he dominated two particular tournaments from an England point of view in terms of goals. He contributed, I don't know what the percentage of goals were in those two World Cups, but it must be about 80-85% of the goals came from him alone. And that's a really significant tally, especially when World Cups were a little bit more condensed, more concertinaed with fewer teams, and probably the standard was maybe a little bit higher in some of the group games. So, you know, in my view, he's one of the greats, one of the great England strikers, one of the great strikers of English football. I would love to have seen him in the Premier League in the rebranded version. It always feels like his exit kind of marks the end of an era of players like him. But then I'm also a little bit relieved he didn't go down. I mentioned him earlier. I'm a bit relieved he didn't go down the Ian Rush route of winding down his career and struggling to score and struggling to make an impact elsewhere. We kind of have that memory of Lineker, of, you know, his last kick of the ball in England being as a Tottenham player. And all the great things he did with England between, or he did in English football between 86 and 91, 92, depending on when you want to cut off his England career as a potent force.
Oh, great. Okay. And in club terms, we start to wind this down. In club terms, where, Chris Evans, where do you view Lineker's peak as having been? Now, we've talked through some more detail than others of Leicester, Everton, Barcelona, Tottenham, and so on. But which era, which spell was actually his peak as a club player? I mean, the England highs kind of bookend it all.
I mean, it's a hell of a question, that is. I mean, I suppose from a club perspective, he's at the top of the tree when he's playing for Barcelona. That every move, Leicester to Everton to Barcelona, was a step up every time. And, you know, no disrespect to Tottenham, but I think that move, you know, Spurs aren't bigger than Barcelona and wasn't a bigger move at the time. So I suppose at that point, perhaps we're talking, you know, in those first two seasons at Barcelona. And I suppose, you know, that coincides, you know, being post 86 as well, when he was recognised as, you know, he was the holder of the golden boot from the World Cup. But I mean, it's a weird one. And this work comes back to the whole Everton question, because that's when he was his most prolific. He scored 40 goals that season. And he definitely, you can't be a failure and you score 40 goals. So from a goals perspective, that probably was the peak of his powers, and that led to the move. But yeah, I would probably say, look, first, second season at Barcelona. So we're talking around, what, 87, 88 would probably be the right peak of the time. But he was still winning golden boots when he came back to play for Tottenham, remember? And he nearly won it in his final season before he kind of went off to Grand Passeig at the end of it. So, I mean, I don't know that there was, once he was at that high level, I think that, you know, to what Chris was saying earlier, once you're kind of, he's at that level, he retains that level for several years and keeps scoring goals. So, yeah, I mean, but yeah, the Barcelona's my answer, but I think it's very difficult. It's by a nose.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, I hope for everyone, this chat has given a good flavour of Lineker's career across club and country, and of course what to expect from this excellent book. And congratulations, Chris, it is a superb book that we've both been fortunate enough to have a good read of. Gary Lineker, A Portrait of a Football Icon by Chris Evans, which is already out in all of the usual places. I guess the next question, or final question for you, Chris, is what's next for you now that this one is out in the open?
Well, I mean, it's just a case of working out, and I suppose, I mean, the nature of the beast is there's a few different irons in the fire, but it's a case of getting deals over the line. I suppose, you know, I mean, I had a How to Win the World Cup that came out for the World Cup in 2022. We'll give that another push in 2026 as well. But yeah, there are other things coming, but it's just a case of agreeing something that works for me and somebody else and people are actually going to buy. So yeah, we'll see.
Okay, keep your eyes peeled for more Chris Evans writing coming up then. Well, thank you, everybody. Thanks, Chris Lepkowski. It's a shame we had to slag off Poland at times, but them's the breaks, mate.
That's the way it goes. It has been a pleasure, and I can only echo, really. I've read Chris's book. It is brilliant. And I'd be interesting to ask, actually, Chris, how much did Gary Lineker know about this book? And what conversations might you have had with him, or did you have with him about it?
So I didn't talk to Gary. Now, this wasn't a case of not wanting to necessarily. So Bloomsbury, obviously the publisher, we'd spoken about this, and they thought that it was probably the best thing to do was not to speak to Gary, just because of the way that it works. And if you bring somebody else in, how does that all fit together? Now, having spoken to quite a lot of people who are still friends with him, like Alan Smith, Gordon Milne, are in a WhatsApp group, then go for dinner with him. Still quite a lot of, you know, people who actually didn't feature in the book still, you know, consider him good friend. Gary Mabbutt was saying about that when I spoke to him. It's it's a case of then he must have been aware of what we were doing. Towards the end, again, I've mentioned Patrick Barkley a few times, you know, and he was brilliant throughout. And, it, you know, actually, you see that a lot of the tributes in recent months about him, you know, he was brilliant for so many journalists. And I think that's quite an important thing here. Like, I mean, that they gave me a cover quote on it and he was so supportive throughout. He was big mates still with his agent and shared the proofs when they were finished with them. So they saw them in advance as well. But yeah, it was something that was done independently. You know, there was so much stuff because Lineker had got, you know, he did a Leicester Mercury column. He was, you know, somebody who the media liked to talk to. There was so much Lineker stuff we could get and kind of get a flavour of how he felt then rather than how he re-remembered things now. And again, that's kind of that point of difference a little bit now because he is still around as such a public figure. So yeah, that's kind of how it fit in that regard. And where, you know, I could well have lumbered in and spoken to Gary and it might not have been the right thing to have done. So I kind of follow the experts on that one.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, well, let's hope Gary approves once he'd read the final proof and enjoyed it as much as we did reading it. So congratulations, Chris, on this excellent book. We can't recommend it highly enough to everyone listening. So thank you, everyone, for listening. Also, I hope you've enjoyed this trip down memory lane. And do please join us again on the Lob podcast from These Football Times. Thank you and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.